Last night, Shawnee Mission School District ended a months-long search, naming Dr. Mike Fulton as its next leader. Today, we'll talk to the incoming superintendent and the school board president about the future of the Shawnee Mission schools. Then a conversation with the musical man who seems to have done it all. You can hear his compositions in the background of the Manchurian Candidate. He's played alongside legends Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, and Nina Simone. He was a U.S. Goodwill Ambassador of Jazz. Today we'll look back on his storied career and close with this week's State House Blend Missouri. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news.
Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Today, a conversation with a man who's done it all in the world of music. That's David Amram. That's coming up in just a bit. But first, the Shawnee Mission School District has a new superintendent. In an announcement made last night, the Shawnee Mission School Board named Michael Fulton as its new leader. Currently serving as superintendent of the Pattonville, Missouri School District, Fulton began his career in education teaching 5th and 6th grade in Bloomington, Illinois. He'll assume his position with the Shawnee Mission District on July 1st. With us are Brad Stratton. He's president of the Shawnee Mission School District Board. And Brad, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
Also with us is the man of the hour, the new superintendent of the Shawnee Mission School District. That's Michael Fulton. And Michael, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate that.
You know, you began, Michael, as a teacher. I'm wondering what made you want to be an administrator?
Well, that was a difficult decision. You know, I was a teacher in Bloomington, Illinois, teaching at that time sixth grade, and had opportunities to go into administration, but really I wanted to continue my journey as a teacher, and so moved to the school district of Clayton to teach middle school to continue to improve my craft. I love teaching. It's hard to leave the classroom, but I had an opportunity in Pattonville 23 years ago to joined their team as director of planning, assessment, and research, and it was a good opportunity to just continue to develop as an educator.
This is a big change for you, going from Pattonville, Missouri, one high school, to the big Shawnee Mission School District. Why did you want to come here?
You know what really drew me to Shawnee Mission? Well, there were a couple things. One is it has a great reputation, of course. Shawnee Mission is a wonderful school district. One of the things I know that they've also started to work on are issues of changing demographics. They're growing more diverse. They've had an increase in poverty. That's common across the United States. And that's something that we've had a lot of success with in Pattonville. And so I was drawn to the position because I thought that could be a really good fit.
How fortuitous is the timing of your arrival here, Michael, because you're coming just as the state Supreme Court has ordered hundreds of millions of dollars in new spending on schools. That strikes me as a nice way to get started.
You know, it is a nice way to get started, but honestly, that was not what I was looking at. My feeling was is after 23 years in Pattonville and the last 11 as superintendent, we've done great work here. We were at a wonderful point to transition leadership. And so as I started to think about what would the next phase of my life's journey look like, I started to think about how I could take the learning from the Pattonville context and apply that somewhere else in ways that would be helpful to children and to the community. And so I think Shawnee Mission is a great fit for that.
We're visiting with the new superintendent of the Shawnee Mission School District. That's Michael Fulton. We're also joined by Brad Stratton, who's president of the school board. Brad, why Michael Fulton?
Well, after a long process of examining the 67 candidates that were provided to us through application process, We whittled it down pretty quickly through the use of our consultant. And we had as many as a dozen, and then narrowed it down to 6. And then the public got to meet the last 3. And in that process, that was very important to us because we wanted public engagement throughout the process, transparency, awareness of what's going on in engagement. Why Michael Fulton? The public told us at the beginning of this process they wanted somebody who could build consensus, inspire trust, and lead. And the words that kept coming up over and over again was, he's a collaborative leader. Hmm. He's someone that can empower others, build a team, delegate, empower, and lead. So those are the things that really stood out with us. I'll add one more piece, and that is recruiting. He has the ability to continue to recruit and develop, and I'll call mentor others as well. And that's great for the future leadership in our district.
You know, Brad, any new leader of a large organization oftentimes is picked as a response to the outgoing leader. What's your sense of how Michael Fulton will differ from his predecessor, Jim Henson? And maybe you just said some of that.
Well, I think what was important was to maybe set that part aside. And instead, we went back to the community and said, what is important to you in the new leader? So maybe some of those traits came as a byproduct of a comparison, but others were forward-looking. And people were saying, these are the things that we think are important. The teachers were a very important source for input to us, too. They're the boots on the ground in the classroom interacting with our customers, the students, and those characteristics came out important, too. So one of the things we're going to do when Dr. Fulton arrives is make sure that he's out in those buildings, out in the classrooms, and out in the community engaging all aspects of the Shawnee Mission community.
What do you think the biggest challenge is that Michael Fulton will face, Brad?
Well, certainly we are a bigger district than where he's coming from, so that would be an obvious one at the front end. But I've been reminding folks that most people that apply for jobs typically don't do it to districts that are smaller than their own. It's essentially a rung on the ladder process, and so we realize that we're either going to have some people that might be at similar size districts, but most smaller. So once we looked through that, we said to ourselves, who has already shown the ability to lead at their level of district, and how will that translate into the new district? So I think that's the first hurdle. The second might be getting to understand the Kansas landscape as it relates to school funding.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly, that school funding formula process is a tough one to bite off.
But and I think good luck with that, right, Brad?
Yeah. And I think the seven of us on the board and the administrative team that's already in place can be helpful in that transition.
Yeah. Michael, how would you describe your style of leadership? That word's coming up a lot here in our conversation this morning. How would you describe it?
Well, it is exactly as Brad described. You know, most of my career has been spent working with teachers to improve teaching and learning for children. The only way that you really get to improvement in learning in any school district of any size is you have to be able to work together as a team to look at what the children's needs are, and design solutions at the local level, at the school level, to make sure that you have the instructional strategies and structures in place to help them in their learning. That is a very collaborative process by design. It's a methodical process. It takes time to build those good structures. And that's the way I work with folks, and because that's what works. And so it has an outcome of having teachers feel good about their work because they have voice in the solutions that are developed for kids. And also you get students and parents involved in that design process as well. You just have to make sure that your target, your focus is always on students and their learning, and you're using good information to make sure that that's happening in ways that are equitable and get kids ready for their future.
You know, Brad, as you know better than any of us, Jim Henson, again, Michael's predecessor, was criticized for this top-down management style and a certain brand of intimidation at times. I'm hearing an approach that's going to be very different than that.
I would say that there's a responsibility to provide balanced governance between the role of the board and the role of a superintendent. And we've spent a lot of time already analyzing that. A reminder that because of the elections last fall, we have three brand new school board members. Some of them are 5 weeks in the job, and they've gone through this entire hiring process in 5 weeks. Hmm. We were very intentional about waiting for them to get here. But back to the leadership style, I think there is an important balance between the role of the board as far as governance goes, oversight, making sure that we continue to set the priorities, and then we hire the key administrative leader to carry out those priorities. And there's a balance, and we're going to be very intentional about that in day one, continuing to get community input, parent input, teacher input, and student input to make sure that that strategic plan going forward is one that is developed from the ground up and then perhaps administered from the top down, or more importantly, from within.
You know, Michael Fulton, oftentimes when you hear about new superintendents, you hear about new curricula. Is that on the agenda?
My focus is going to be spent on getting to know, building relationships, first and foremost, but also understanding the strength that's already in Shawnee Mission. What are the systems? What's the curriculum? Listening to what's working well, and then maybe what are some things that we need to work on to help students a bit better in their learning and also support teachers. That's the starting point. And so beginning there, I'll begin to get a sense of where Shawnee Mission is in supporting children in their learning, and we'll work as a team to begin to address the areas that we need to take on first.
Now, Michael, this is
a lot of learning up front.
This just strikes me as such a hard time to be an educator, maybe particularly in Kansas, where you've seen budget cuts and turmoil when it comes to what the funding levels are, varying from year to year, state Supreme Court interventions, talk of constitutional crises if lawmakers don't buy into what the state Supreme Court is mandating here. I hear you saying part of your job is to sort of calm the waters a little bit.
It is. It is to calm the waters. You only control what you control. You know, with respect to school budgets, you plan as best you can. If the future's a bit uncertain, then you just budget conservatively. But you make sure that to the very best of your ability, the resources are getting to the school level where the kids are. And you just do your very best to resource the priorities that lead to learning. That's true in Kansas. It's true across the country.
You know, Brad, I'm wondering, you know, in the last decade, perhaps, I think this is fair to say, that the perception a decade ago was that the Shawnee Mission District was the premier district in Johnson County. Today, you get a sense that if you put it to a vote of people, that maybe the Blue Valley schools would have the upper hand. I'm wondering, does that bother you, and does Shawnee Mission need to play catch-up here?
Well, I'll tactfully say I beg to differ. However,
okay.
I think those comparisons are said regularly as well. I think the demographic shift that continues to move through the greater Kansas City metro certainly has affected what's going on in Shawnee Mission.
Meaning the first ring suburbs are in a different position than where the Blue Valley schools are.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Some of our schools are dealing with just as many social and emotional social service issues as they are education issues. That's where Shawnee Mission has needed to adapt. I'm actually excited about it because the diversity is really going to be a strength going forward, the diversity of socioeconomic as well as ethnicity. And by bringing a new leader who already understands that from his district, he had extremes on both ends, socioeconomic, from where he's from. That was important.
Why is that a strength? Because there are people out there who might think, it's a weakness.
I think the students that we are teaching, and more importantly, developing, will come to appreciate that if they learn it at an early age, that we can be honest about it, we can identify it. I think what you hear about it is from maybe a generation or go, the Shawnee Missions that hang on to that legacy, which is equally important. But I think we need to continue to remind people this is the reality of not only Shawnee Mission, the greater community, and then the role of schools. And I think that's even changing a little bit too, which is why we have that constant back and forth with what's going on in Topeka.
You know, Michael, one other thing maybe it's worth asking at this point. Jim Henson, again, your predecessor, at one point proposed moving sixth graders to middle school. But after parent opposition, the idea wasn't implemented. What do you make of this idea of moving sixth graders into the middle schools? It's been kicked around for years. Where are you on that?
You know, that's a really good question. It actually came up at the community forum. And having taught sixth grade at both in elementary and middle school settings, I understand the issue. So the question on the table is, what is it that we want to try to achieve? Is it a learning issue that we're addressing? Is it social emotional development? And so I think you kind of go back to the base. What is the outcome that we're actually trying to achieve mm-hmm. by moving sixth graders from an elementary to a middle school setting? Those are the kinds of things that I would want to sit down and talk with the community about, and really make sure that we're asking the right questions. Do we really? What's the problem that we're trying to solve? why are we trying to solve that problem in that way? So I look forward to that conversation.
Michael, maybe just a final question here, and I sure appreciate your time and coming on the show here today. You know, education is always changing, morphing from one thing to another. What's the biggest change that's roiling the education landscape right now?
Well, I think it goes back to Brad's comments, and that is the issue of growing diversity in our nation. I strongly believe that diversity in school districts is a strength. And part of the narrative that I think Pattonville has demonstrated is that diversity equals high achievement. You should have high achievement with a diverse population, and you have to adjust practices to meet your students where they start in life and journey them to where they are, in fact, high school ready and their college and career ready. It's doable. It takes a lot of teamwork. It takes persistence and time. But as we move to a society that by 2020, if current demographic projections hold, the majority of 0 to 18-year-olds in this country will be children of color. That's a wonderful tapestry of diversity to have. And so that's exciting. But it's important that we make sure that we design our schools so every single child is going to be successful in their learning. And that probably will require different strategies going forward than maybe we've used in the past.
That's Michael Fulton. He's the new superintendent of the Shawnee Mission School District, just named last night. Michael, again, thanks for the time. Congratulations. We're all going to be rooting for you.
Thank you so much.
Brad Stratton also joined us today. He's president of the Shawnee Mission School Board. Brad, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for the invitation.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with a man who's done it all in the world of music. That's David Amram. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we learned how states like Missouri are using gerrymandering to make voting districts less partisan. If you missed it, you can find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, the history of Mexican-American identity and how manifest destiny impacts race relations. Also, an update on turmoil in the Jackson County Legislature. That's on tomorrow's Up to Date. Well, what do you say about a guy who's worked with Frank Sinatra and Pete Seeger, Leonard Bernstein and Willie Nelson, Charles Mingus and the Pennsylvania Opera? What do you say about a guy who, at last count, can play 35 instruments, wrote the score for The Manchurian Candidate, which we'll listen to in just a moment here, and is hip to Native American music? You can say a lot of things about David Amram, and certainly you can say this. He's a different kind of cat, as he was described last year in Kansas City. He says simply that he's been a full-time student at the University of Hangoutology, mining the world of music to the point that he ranks as a living, breathing musical encyclopedia. The Folk Alliance International, which stages its fifth conference in Kansas City this weekend, honored David last year with a Lifetime Achievement Award. He's back in town this year to perform at the conference and to appear here on Up to Date. And David, what a pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's so nice to be back in Kansas City again.
You brought a whole array of tools with you here, different instruments. What do you got in front of you?
Well, I brought some of the instruments which I acquired and appreciated from around the world, and I found people who were gracious enough to take the time to show me a little bit, with the tacit understanding that when I return here at home in the States, I would try to share that with other people. And instruments like the beautiful Chinese hulusai, or from Guatemala, the beautiful double ocarina.
It's like a big lunchbox you're playing there.
Yeah, it just has such a wonderful, beautiful, melancholy sound. And the instruments like the tambourine that we often see in some popular music of a friend of the band's attorney thumping away, we forget that the tambourine is used in many religions here in the United States, in the Sanctified Church and in a lot of other religions as a glorious instrument. And in the Middle East, not to mention Brazil, South America, and other places, the tambourine often leads the band.
You're playing it differently than I've ever seen a tambourine play before.
Well, they in Egypt, when I was there, the band leader came out with a tambourine. I said, wow. And he played the tambourine on his shoulder and led the whole band. And I flash back to when Dizzy Gillespie gave a concert, and he said, now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a special soloist from Brazil. And the man came out just holding a tambourine, and everybody laughs. Oh, I guess Dizzy's, you know, has such a good sense of humor.
Yeah.
And this guy played about a 10-minute solo that was staggering and never repeated any of the figures twice. And a lot of the folk instruments, as we would call them, like in from our own country, which people loved in other countries, the wonderful Native American flute, or the shiho, is such a glorious instrument. And Dvorak knew that, of course. In his New World Symphony, he mentioned the beauties of Native American and African American music and how that could give composers a whole new way of contributing to the standard repertoire, not dumping European music, but adding to it with things that we had here that we were blessed to have. And of course, here in Missouri, people know about that. And now the whole world is finding out that, thanks to the internet and cyberspace, that there's Native American people or Native people all over the whole American continent. And lots of times an instrument can bring you to that place from where it comes and give you a sense and a feeling of being connected.
And that one, that last one certainly did.
Yeah, and I used that particular motif in a piece I wrote for the Philadelphia Orchestra called Trail to Beauty. And Eugene Normandy, the great European conductor, said, David, sing that one for the boys. They had some women in the orchestra, too, but it was predominantly males in the 70s. And I did that, and the orchestra applauded because they weren't used to seeing a composer even say hello.
Yes.
Or be allowed to say hello.
Yeah.
And then when I sang it, they realized that it wasn't just something done on a synthesizer, a computer, or taken from a bottle of formaldehyde.
Yeah.
But actually some music that's been here for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so many of the sincere musics that have been built to last do have that enduring value, and therefore are classical. And that would, of course, include all the music from Kansas City. And since I was lucky enough to play with Mary Lou Williams and Lester Young and New Charlie Parker in 1952,
I want to ask you about that.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, musician David Amram is my guest. He's in town for the Folk Alliance Conference, the fifth conference being held this weekend in Kansas City. You know, what is it? You once said that you mentioned Charlie Parker. He mentored you back in, I think, 1952.
Right.
Just a few years before he passed away. Tell me about meeting Charlie Parker and what he said to you.
Well, it was extraordinary. A friend of mine who was a friend of the great band leader, Joe Timer, his wife was also named Joe, and she said, you have to come down and hear Bird. He was playing at the Howard Theater. She said, I know him. In New York? Pardon me?
In New York? No,
this was in Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C.
And I met him, and he was just so warm and wonderful. And I was a 21-year-old hayseed musician living in a basement apartment, studying history at George Washington University, playing extra horn, French horn, in the National Symphony, and had a little jazz group with a bassoon player and a flute player who also played the saxophone. And we had a group that played Renaissance trios, transcriptions I tried to make of Lee Konitz and Charlie Parker and Miles and all these great plings, and then just free improvised music. And he came down to our basement apartment in Washington and heard us play and encouraged us and came back one or two times and played, jammed with us. And encouraged us to try to work hard, not to give up our classical training, but to add to it with the beauty of the classical music, which we call jazz.
Charlie Parker did exactly the same thing, loved classical music.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And he did that, and he was, in fact, when you hear Bird with Strings, it's magnificent. It was like Marcel Mule, who used to play with the Boston Symphony. He had that gorgeous sound.
We just did a show on it last week, Bird with Strings. We played some of it on the air here.
And you know, it's just so incredibly beautiful. And he set a standard for all of us to try to think in a broader way and to realize Bartok and Stravinsky felt the same way about jazz as being an enduring art form, and all folk music as being something of lasting value, built to last.
Yeah, this notion that jazz is something lesser than orchestral music or, you know, classical music, you say what to that?
Well, I would say that since I'm 87 years old, every bit of misinformation that we have about everything I was brought up with,
mm-hmm.
I was told, boom, 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 by Beethoven, the anvil of fate that came in a direct pipeline from the great creator, not realizing perhaps that was Beethoven's landlady, because he had a woman who was his landlord, who say, please pay your rent. And
is that the story?
No, that's my story.
That's your story,
but,
yeah.
But basically, he was a working...
I would have bought it, yeah.
He was a working musician.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to take something that simple and build a whole magnificent symphony around that. And what musicians do is what any, and I was brought up on a farm, so I can say it authentically, is what any great farmer or any great working person would do, whether you're putting the 14th coat of shellac on the floor to get it really right and mm-hmm. not forgetting to sand it, to do a good job and do better than is expected is what all art and all music and all work of any value is about.
So when you were hanging with Charlie Parker in 52, he was just still in the process of revolutionizing the music. Did you recognize that who he was? Was he a pioneer at that moment?
Well, most of us that knew about him and had heard his records were so staggered by how different it was,
mm-hmm.
and how beautiful it was, how complicated, and every single note meant something and seemed to be right, and it was so different. And when I was asked by the director of the manager of the New York Philharmonic, when I was interviewed and I mentioned Gesualdo and the great pre-Bach composers right up through the giants of our music of that time, and everyone from Louis Armstrong and Kid Ory and Big Spiderbeck and all the great Kansas City giants, mm-hmm. like Lester Young and mm-hmm. Bird and Mary Lou Williams, who I was blessed to know.
Yeah, amazing.
And he said, how can you equate barroom entertainers with the treasures of European music? I said, what they all share in common is purity of intent and an exquisite choice of notes. And I thought, man, that would... he looked at me and I could see in his eyes, why did Leonard Bernstein choose this turkey? We'll be glad. And yeah. it wasn't because he was a bad person. He was brilliant, but he had a limited viewpoint of the field that he was in. Because
Charlie, you're talking about?
No, the person who was managing the orchestra.
Right.
That couldn't
wrap his arms around it.
Yeah, exactly. That couldn't open up his heart and his mind and his ears to hearing how beautiful so much of the work of jazz is, and how the art of improvisation was something that was a part of the giants of 17th and 18th and early 19th
right.
century European music. And what Charlie Parker said was, when I said, Bird, you wrote Now's the Time, which is kind of our anthem.
Oh, it's an anthem here in town still. Yeah,
yeah. And I was 21 years old. I said, Bird, you wrote that in 1945. This was 1952. And that was a third of my life, which is a long period. When you're 21, that's Mm-hmm. They said, no, man. He said, now's the time. We'll always be right. He said, because now was, is, and always will be the time, because now is the right time. So even though he was so concerned with all the different beautiful musics that he heard and absorbed and created, he always lived in the sanctity of the moment. And that's one of the great things that jazz reminds us of, is to be alive,
yes,
celebrate all those who surround us, respect every single person whose path you cross with. Even if they're abusive to you, try to understand where they're coming from and be present and respectful. And if you are, every day will be a miracle and life will be worthwhile. And I can say, if I may, since I'm 87, when you get older, you can stay healthy because you realize every day is the first and only day, and every person can teach you something, and every moment is really precious.
David Amran is my guest. He'll be talking about his life as a composer, musician, and author in a conversation tonight at 7 with KCUR's Chuck Haddix. Afterwards, David will take part in a concert with Victor and Penny and the Loose Change Orchestra, featuring tunes by Kansas City jazz greats and compositions by Amran. This will take place at this evening at 7 at the Olathe Downtown Library, 201 East Park Street. You know, you once said, David, that when something touched you, you tried to get closer to it. And I gather by that you meant that you didn't care what type of music touched you as long as it touched you.
Exactly. I couldn't have said it any better myself. And yeah. I guess I did.
I guess
I did it one time. And that's hard to explain, because someone who's a career counselor might whip out their computer or iPhone and say, well, wait a minute. The demographics show that there's no market for that.
And you never cared about market, David.
Well, I appreciate that. It's certainly better to have something. I mean, I had to support my family, and now their kids are grown up, bless their heart. And I still have to pay my rent, and I still have to work, which I love to do. So to me, it's a blessing to be able to do it. But at the same time, if I worried about that, I wouldn't have done anything. And so I try to encourage kids to realize, if you want to be not just a musician, but an artist, an actor, a dancer, a carpenter, a computer programmer, a real estate salesman, a farmer, whatever you do, to figure you have to do it better than is expected, to do a really good job, and that what you do to pay your rent has no bearing on your value as an artist or a person, a working person of any kind. And secondly, in our society, what you deserve and what you get have almost no relationship with each other. But if you do it because you feel you were put here to do it and do a really good job, you can do what Dizzy Gillespie told me when he was asked by an interviewer the question, how are you going to continue to be doing this, Mr. Gillespie? And he's told me his answer was, bop till you drop.
Well, maybe you're explaining why you're so eclectic, because different kinds of music clearly touched you. Why is it that in society we sort of funnel people into these tunnels? You're either a jazz person, you're a classical person, you're a folk person, and you can't be anything else.
Well, that's because of a certain way that we have as a genius of branding everybody into something so that they can have their own cell block in what I call the penitentiary of bad taste. But they're not allowed to speak to other people in other cell blocks to find out not what their branding is, but what they actually do. And very often, those stereotypes that are built around people and about the work they pursue becomes their brand. And the danger of that is that then you're forced to be that stereotype that you're not in the first place, or you're considered to be a traitor to your brand.
But do you lose something in the course of being so versatile? Because some might say when you're so versatile, you can't excel in any one form because you're dancing around among so many.
Well, you see, the symphony that I'm, my latest symphonic piece called Partners, is for violoncello and orchestra. The first set of partners are Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, whom I knew and was blessed to play with. The second are Kansas City's own Lester Young and Billie Holiday and their musical partnership. And the third are Celia Cruz and Machito, who's brought Afro-Cuban music to this country and to the world. And I knew all six of them independently. I never dreamed I would write a symphonic piece, but when I do my classical compositions where it's all written down, I have the option of being able to take all of those things that I've experienced and put them in a framework that wouldn't be the same if I had gotten it from a bottle of formaldehyde that guarded by someone who never experienced that by being a member of the University of Hangoutology. So for me, it's one gigantic field trip. And when I sit all alone at home like a solitary nerd composing the music, I can figure out what seems to be natural because I learned it from and participated in it with people who came from the heart, who were fabulous and were nice enough to share their work with me.
You know, we're talking a lot about jazz, but you also are known for composing the theme to The Manchurian Candidate, and Frank Sinatra loved your work here. Let's listen to a little bit of this. That's gorgeous.
Oh, thank you.
Frank Sinatra said you captured the sense of that film perfectly in that score.
Oh, thank you. Well, I did the whole score, and I orchestrated it, conducted it, got the jazz musicians, the great Harold Land and all these people that I had known. And they were shocked. They said, well, what's the matter with that guy? He's sitting there in the room orchestrating and spending all that time. Where's your staff of helpers and ghostwriters and orchestrators? I said, I don't do that stuff. I'm a musician and a composer. And when I worked with the great Betty Carter, your own Bobby Watson, I remember, played saxophone. He played so gorgeously. Mm-hmm. We did a program with the Detroit Symphony, and the people in the orchestra said, wow, man, who is that guy? And when they heard Betty Carter, they said, boy, we never experienced anything like that. And I said, I didn't either. Right. That's why when she asked me to work with her, I wouldn't ever turn it down, because I learn something each time. And it's the purity of intent and exquisite choice of notes. And I wrote that in 1962, the whole score. And I'd never had to apologize by saying, well, I just did that because that was my movie music. I work as hard on that as I do when I'm writing a symphony.
Yeah.
And sometimes when the Woody Guthrie Symphony, This Land Symphonic Variations of a Song with Woody Guthrie, which I left here for the station, that was done by the Colorado Symphony, recorded. And in that particular piece, I used every bit of music that I ever knew that Woody Guthrie was involved with. So everything that I do when I'm at the Folk Alliance and I play with Victor and Penny, whom I met here, and all these great people, that's all part of my education and my inspiration for being around excellence.
Let's do this. We just have a couple minutes left. Just give me 20 seconds on a bunch of the people you've worked with here, okay? Frank Sinatra. Just 20 seconds.
I would say certainly Leonard Bernstein, Dimitri Petropoulos, Frank Sinatra, Johnny Depp. In the jazz world, especially from Kansas City, Mary Lou Williams, whom I recorded and played with, Lester Young, Charlie Parker, Jimmy Witherspoon, the great singer.
But tell
Buddy
me about
Tate.
Frank.
Pardon?
Tell me about Frank.
Well, about Frank Sinatra?
Yeah.
Well, people were so frightened of him when I was there. I only got to meet him 5 years later when I was playing at the Village Gate, and someone said, Frank's downstairs and wants to meet you. I said, Frank who? And they said, Frank Sinatra. I said, oh. And I went downstairs, and he said, you know, he really liked my music. And I always admired his singing, his acting, and his love of all music, that is musicality.
Dizzy Gillespie, just quickly.
In 1951, I met him, and he became a mentor and a friend of mine and an inspiration for my whole life. We went to Cuba together in 1977, and I was just there 2 weeks ago at the International Jazz Festival after 41 years, and everyone in Cuba just said, we know you, yeah, we're Dizzy. They love him today as much as if he was a 17-year-old hero, because he influenced the whole world to be more beautiful and more harmonious.
Leonard Bernstein, just very quickly.
Also a giant who loved music more than he loved himself.
Intimidating.
Pardon?
Intimidating.
Not really, no. He was so warm and gracious. He was just so brilliant and so much ahead of all of us that he wanted you to rise to his level.
We have to cut it off there, and I hate to do it. That's David Amram. Again, he performs this evening at 7 at the Olathe Downtown Library, 201 East Park Street. What an amazing guy you are. Thanks for taking some time with us. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and it's beautiful to be back in Kansas City every time. There's still the center, soul center of all of our great music.
Thanks very much. It's time now for State House Blend Missouri. Jefferson City was in the national spotlight last week when a state district that voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump elected a Democrat to the State House. Now people are wondering if this is a sign that Democrats will win on the congressional level during the midterm elections this year. What does this victory actually mean for the state, and can it really tell us anything about what's to come in 2018? KCUR's Brian Ellison sat down with KU political science professor Patrick Miller to get perspective on these special elections.
The four districts that were up were all pretty Republican tilting districts to different degrees. The one that is actually the most friendly for Democrats is the one that Democrats picked up. It's a district where Barack Obama got 43% of the vote in 2012, but that fell down to just 33% for Hillary Clinton. The other districts were far less friendly for Democrats. So not exactly fertile territory for them to make gains, even in a weirdly timed election like this. But they did flip the district that was friendliest to them and came pretty close to actually flipping a second district that was markedly more Republican.
Republicans won 3 out of 4 districts. That seems like good news for Republicans. Are Republicans looking at these results and saying, wow, that was a great special election day for us?
No. And in fact, you can find many a Missouri Republican on Twitter who is quite upset about it, pointing fingers at various different people in the state, including the governor. The bottom line for them is that the one district that is plausibly in the realm of competitiveness, though maybe on the outskirts of that, they lost that. And that is not a positive sign going forward to November 2018, when you're going to have a lot more districts like that on the ballot. The interesting part of the electorate that is shifting the most right now is suburbia, particularly suburbs that are higher education, higher income, traditionally Republican, quite white on average. Many of these actually flipped to Clinton in 2016, where they voted for Romney before, or she ran ahead of Obama's numbers in many of these places. And in the last year, that's especially where Democrats have been doing well in both regularly timed elections and specials, is in the suburbs. So if you look at the district that flipped here in Missouri, it is more of a suburban seat, certainly the most suburban of them all. I mean, certainly, I mean, Claire McCaskill had won the district when she ran for re-election. So Democrats have won there. But she also had a very unusual election. I mean, for me, looking at that before the election, I saw 43% as the high watermark recently for Democrats with Obama. So I wouldn't have bet on that one flipping. And that should be a troubling sign for Republicans that it is.
I guess one more question, Patrick. Does any of this matter? And maybe that's just a matter of opinion based on what you care about. But at the end of the day, 4 seats in a House that is still overwhelmingly controlled by Republicans hasn't changed the balance of power in any way. Do you think seeing these results is likely to change the way the General Assembly approaches any particular issues? Will it affect the legislation that's coming out?
I mean, one thing we know about politicians is that they do respond to the mood of the electorate before elections often happen. Well, if they're smart, they do. And, you know, if Republicans, particularly suburban Republicans, are anticipating a negative environment this year, that may possibly make the, whatever they do this session a bit less conservative, playing it safer, at least until after the election.
That's Patrick Miller. He's a political science professor at KU, but knows a good thing about Missouri or two, and has been very helpful in helping me understand what's really going on with special elections. Patrick, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Kind of the reason I ran, or what kind of drew me, I've always had an interest in politics, but I wasn't, you know, a political science major. It wasn't really something I'd done in the past.
That's Mike Revis, the Democrat who managed to flip a Republican House seat in last week's special elections in a district that voted overwhelmingly for Trump. He says it wasn't always his plan to get involved, but something happened in the legislature that he couldn't ignore.
I'd been working for Anheuser-Busch for about 4 years, and I was driving home from work back this past summer. And I was listening to a radio station, and they were talking about how quickly right to work had passed in our state. And I grew up in a union home. My dad had 40 years in the Carpenters Union in St. Louis, and my mom had been a public school teacher in the NEA for, you know, over 30 years. So to me, that was a red flag, and that was concerning. So I went home that night. I reached out to the state party. I said, you know, I'm Mike Revis. Here's my background. Here's my passion. This is where I live. I'd like to get involved.
Revis's victory made national headlines, and it spurred a lot of speculation about Democrats scoring more victories in midterm elections later this year. But politics aside, I wanted to know more about the people in a district who could vote for both Donald Trump and a Democrat.
Down here, you know, when we were going door to door, when I was talking to people or when volunteers were talking to people, I always wanted to ask the volunteers when it was through, you know, what were people talking about? What were their passions? What were their concerns? And the big issues down here that were really getting people fired up was the passage of Right to Work and was the attacks on our public education system as well.
So it doesn't sound to me like you're nearly as surprised as everybody else seems to be that this district elected a Democrat.
I knew it was certainly possible, but I knew it wasn't going to be easy. It had a lot to do with the large support we had from the labor community. On one single day, we had over 100 volunteers join us and go knock door to door. And I think that says a lot. That says a lot about the strength of the labor community still, and that you know, people were just energized and tired of the attacks on the working class.
Yeah, the reason people seem interested in it is because they believe it says something about Democrats' prospects beyond your seat. They think it says something about the Trump administration or about the Greitens administration. Do you think that's true? Do you think your vote there in Jefferson County for one seat was a referendum on some bigger things?
After talking with folks down here in this community, I don't think this was a retaliation vote against the governor scandal or President Trump. I think this was a retaliation vote against the attacks on the working class and people pushing back and fighting back against Right to Work.
So you've mentioned Right to Work as a high priority. That's really not on the plate this year in the General Assembly because we're waiting now for the election, or the vote on a ballot
right.
initiative later in the year. What's on your agenda? What do you want to work on?
Yeah, so outside of Right to Work, though, there are other attacks coming towards the labor community. You have prevailing wage, paycheck deception. There's a lot of other
prevailing wage
coming to.
Just to remind folks, prevailing wage is the requirement that municipalities or local entities pay at the so-called prevailing wage that's required under state law. Often that's a union wage, but a lot of municipalities say they can't afford that. It makes things too expensive.
So right. And
you would stand with Democrats who would oppose any changes to the prevailing wage law.
Right. I'd be supporting, you know, our labor background on that issue. And I think that's a big one that's going to be coming up. But then also making sure that we're properly funding our education system.
Governor Greitens in his budget has proposed some pretty substantial increases to K-12 education. Do you support that?
Well, there's some proposed increases for K-12, but then there's also some large decreases proposed for higher ed beyond that. We need to make sure that we're allowing, you know, supporting the highest levels of education throughout the entire state and making sure that people are getting the right education that they need.
It's Mike Revis. He was one of four representatives elected last week. The other three were Republicans. We'll be following all the newly elected representatives to see how much they're changing the State House in the weeks to come. Meanwhile, here's what else you need to know about this week in Missouri government.
For us to say, well, I want to go home, I mean, this is what you're elected to do. You're not elected to go to sleep. You're elected to fight.
That's Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal. She was one of four senators who held the floor in an epic 24-hour filibuster against a bill in the Senate that would have given utility companies a lot more freedom to raise rates. In the end, it may have worked. Compromises off the floor resulted in changes that senators seem to agree retained enough control of rates while also encouraging upgrades to the state's power grid. But the bill needs another vote before it can move to the House. Also, in the ongoing saga of the lobbyist gift ban, remember, that's the ethics bill that would restrict all gifts from lobbyists to legislators to reduce the influence of lobbyists on legislation. Well, a Senate committee moved a bill forward. It still allows gifts, though, as long as they're not more than $40 a day. The sponsor of the House bill, Justin Alferman, says, well, I guess it's better than nothing.
Clearly, the House wanted a zero, kind of a no-tolerance policy for lobbyist gifts. But even at $40, it is still a lot better than the current system that we have.
No word yet on when that will reach the Senate floor. And by the way, if you want to send gifts of $40 a day to State House Blend, we will gladly accept them. And finally, since we know you don't want a week to pass without hearing something about this story, the ex-husband of the woman with whom Governor Eric Greitens has admitted having an affair has been called to testify before a grand jury in St. Louis that's investigating allegations that Greitens blackmailed the woman. That's according to the man's lawyer, though grand jury actions are secret in Missouri, and the St. Louis Circuit Attorney won't confirm or deny the report.
State House Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can hear the full version of that episode by subscribing to the podcast on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on the show, we'll look at how the history of racism in the American Southwest continues to shape our political discourse. We'll also catch up on recent controversies with the Jackson County Legislature. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.